Blog Talk Radio.
Airlines radio show. We're awfully happy that you're listening and you've joined us tonight. We start our broadcast every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on your computer's internet dial, www.ealradioshow.com or at www.blogtalkradio.com/Captain Eddie. The hosts for the radio show are from many different locations, South, North, and Central Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, New York, and then on occasion, Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. That's where I spend my summers. Our hosts for tonight's broadcast include Chuck Albright. Hi, Chuck. How are things in America's favorite retirement village?
Well, we're suffering down here with 74 degrees tonight, partly cloudy and dry. We don't have any rain or snow here, so I guess we're doing... I noticed most of the country enjoying rain and snow today. So come on down here to Florida and come to our retirement village, and you'll be able to enjoy 50 golf courses down here. Back to
wow,
you.
Wow, that's something. Neil Holland is our producer and engineer in beautiful Ponte Vedra, Florida. It's up near St. Augustine. Neil?
Yes, sir. Well, we don't have as many golf courses as Chuck has, but we have the Hall of Fame, the World Hall of Fame of Golf here in Ponte Vedra, St. Augustine area. And the temperatures are beautiful here now. We're in the 70s, and it's been a good week. Jim?
Our official Yankee living in New York is George Jan. George, how's fishing out there in Rockaway, in the peninsula, or in the race? How's that been this year? I hear the blues are plentiful right now.
Yeah, George. That's true. That's true, Neil. No, excuse me, it's not Neil on there, it's Howard. The blues are plentiful, all right, but it's not bluefish. It's giant bluefin tuna have been caught for the past several weeks out at the canyon here, which is about an 80-mile run offshore. The fish are up to 1,000 pounds, and it's totally unexpected, the run. And because the quota wasn't reached this year, the people have been able to keep more than one fish. And it's being continuing during the snow. I mean, it's unheard of, but it's a nice surprise for everyone.
And from beautiful Boca Raton, Florida, just down the street from West Palm Beach, is Cecile Intriago. Cecile is with her partner, Charles, who is an avid fisherman, and we hope to hear from him a little later in the special program this evening. Cecile, how are you doing?
We're doing great. And Jim and I have the same weather in West Palm Beach, which is 79 degrees. Are you hearing me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to sign off. I'm getting an echo. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, we share the same weather as Jim Hart, and it's beautiful, beautiful weather down here in South Florida. Neil?
Okay, well, I'll turn it back over to Jim. Jim?
Okay, fine. And that, of course, leaves me, Jim Hart. I'm here at West Palm Beach where the temperature this past week has been in the low 80s. In fact, it's 80 degrees outside right now. Now for just a little housekeeping. Before we go into our program, our listeners can join our host at any time during the broadcast and share their thoughts and memories of Eastern, or they can ask questions of your host and our guests. Our telephone contact to be live on the air is 213-816-1611 or toll-free at 877-572-1861. Either number will get you to our caller board where you can join in our discussion. Don't forget, if you wish to be with us live, press number 1 on your telephone's keypad.
Two shopping carts late last night. One was full of fishing gear, the other Miller Lite. The checkout lady laughed and said, "You think you've got enough?" And I said, "Yeah, you're probably right." And still another two carts up. Don't catch all the fish, or drink all the beer, or anchor down, or stay in here. Might take all day, might take all year. Don't catch all the fish, drink all the beer. I picked up the boys at dawn and we were on our way. It hadn't been 10 minutes before Jimmy's cell phone rang. His old lady asked him how long we'd be on the lake, and I said, "You tell her we're staying here however long." Don't catch all the fish, drink all the beer. Better warn her now, better make it clear. Might take all day, might take all year. Don't catch all the fish, drink all the beer. Just as long as
Well, that was quite a song. Neil, how about telling us about tonight's show?
Well, it's all about what the song says. Well, not necessarily drinking the beer, but at least fishing. So that's what we're going to try to attempt today, tonight, is tell you a little bit about our fishing experiences. My fishing partner, Howard Mucci, wrote this short story in his recently published book, All the Stories from Here and There. And it's titled Ice Fishing in New England. Some years ago, I worked and lived in Laconia, New Hampshire, a wonderful place with towering snow-capped granite mountains, crystal-clear streams, and two beautiful lakes. It was a hunter and fisherman's paradise in every sense of the word, with all manner of small game, from quail to deer, and a large variety of fish ranging from perch to both small and largemouth bass. However, for some, there was drawback. The summers are brief, and winters are quite long, with accumulated snowfall sometimes exceeding 6 feet. Oddly enough, despite the heavy snowfall, the streets and sidewalks were always clear. I never missed a day of work, and I drove everywhere without snow tires. The month of July is normally considered summer. Winter ends the 1st of July and begins at the end of July. Winter also brings with it an average snowfall of some 36 inches, a pleasure for some and a nightmare for others. When snow begins to fall, and that usually means an accumulation of 12 inches or more, the snow plows, graders, blowers go into action 24 hours a day, every day. The cacophony of sound and the frenetic activity are inescapable. Everywhere you look, snow is being shoved, pushed, piled, shoveled, or blown into piles by the plows and snowblowers. Piles of snow are everywhere. Piles soon become mountains of snow in parking lots, along driveways, on both sides of the road. The more it snows, the higher the mountains of snow. To get away from all the snow and perhaps household chores as well, real New Hampshire men go ice fishing. What is considered the ideal fishing weather is a temperature of around 15 degrees Fahrenheit, a little sunshine, and not much wind. This is a sport requiring a solid sheet ice on the lake that is usually at least 18 inches thick, which is normal in January. And, of course, you can't ice fish without a bob house. Now, a bob house is a portable fishing shanty placed on a frozen body of water to protect the fisherman while he or she fishes through the hole in its floor. No one seems to know the term's origins. Some say it's from the bob on the line letting the fisherman know he's hooked something. Some say it's from the way the shanties themselves might bob a few times before going under when their owners forget to bring them in off the ice before the spring thaw. Some of the hardier souls will leave the shelter of the bob house and, using an auger, make additional fishing holes outside the bob house. If there's any wind, these additional holes are always made on the leeward side of the bob house with good reason. The wind chill factor can easily fall below zero, which makes baiting the hook with bare hands a challenge, if not a numbing experience. In each hole is placed what is called a tip-up, which is a simple device that tips up a flag when the fish has taken the bait. All one has to do after baiting the hook is drop it in the hole, and after cocking the flag, watch and wait for the fish to bite. On this particular day, it was mid-morning as I accompanied two of my friends to Lake Winnipesaukee for some ice fishing. One of them owned a bob house, or shanty, situated some 500 feet from shore. We carried our gear consisting of a large bucket of live smelt we were using for bait, fishing tip-ups, hand auger, firewood for the pot-bellied stove, coffee and thermos bottles, and sandwiches for lunch. We made our way across the ice to the bob house, started the fire in the pot-bellied stove, and using the auger, made three holes in the ice inside the bob house. Everybody set their tip up in this hole, poured a cup of coffee, and intently watched the flag on their tip up. We'd been fishing for some time without much success when the other two fishermen decided to make some new holes outside the bob house. I was left alone inside the bob house and quite comfortable, the small pot-bellied stove providing ample heat. I was patiently watching my tip of when it suddenly occurred to me that I had left my lunch in the car. Now, not too keen on traipsing across the ice 500 feet back to the car, I resigned myself to going without lunch. My eyes suddenly focused on smelt swimming in the bucket. Now, fried smelt are delicious and are good any time, moreover, the bait was the perfect size. However, this involves butter and a skillet. I didn't have a skillet, but the hot top of the pot-bellied stove would serve as a skillet, I thought. Now, all I needed was a little butter. Necessity being the mother of invention, opening my companion's sandwiches, I noticed one of them had bread that was well buttered on both sides. Using my knife, I carefully scraped the butter off the bread and onto the top of the pot-bellied stove. Then, using a net, scooped out a half dozen smelt and placed them on the hot stove. I carefully turned them until they were nicely brown and was just putting the first one in my mouth when the door opened and my companion shouted, "Good grief! He's eating all our bait!" There was no way to live this down. Every one of my acquaintances somehow knew the story and could not wait to ask me about it. The moral of the story, if you have a hungry fisherman and live smelt, it pays to keep your eye on the bait.
Very good.
Sitting on a bucket with a fishing pole, I'm dropping a line through an icy hole. I know you're down there, I know you're down there, I know you're down there. Swimming underneath an icy ceiling, wanna eat that food, but I got that feeling. I know you're up there, I know you're up there, I
theoretically, the wind blows, hits this piece, and you loosen this part so it'll jig. And then it pulls, and voila, the thing flips up.
In Minnesota, where it's 30 below, you can pass the time with cards or eat a minnow. Is a fishing pole, a bucket, bait, and be jerky. Fishing. All you need is a fishing pole, a bucket, bait, and be jerky. All you need is a fishing pole, a bucket.
Well, the song tells it all about what you need. Howard, are you with us tonight? That's a beautiful story
indeed.
That you wrote. It's a great story that you wrote, Howard.
Thank you.
Yeah, now, I've got a question about ice fishing. Of course, I've never been, and I never want to go. But I guess people have got to do something in the winter. And I guess some people choose to sit out in the cold air, but it must be very comfortable in a little confines of what looks to be about a 10 by 10 foot Bob House. Where in the world did the name Bob House come from, Howard?
Well, you know, you mentioned it earlier in the story. It seems as though the Bob House is named Bob House because there was such a thing as a Bob Sled. And a Bob House is basically a little house on a sled, if you can. But anyhow, nobody knows exactly where it came from. There are several theories. But the interesting thing is, Bob houses can be a very crude wood plywood construction with windows covered by clear film so that the fishermen can watch their tip-ups. They can also be quite sophisticated with glass windows, carpeting, power generators, stoves, and believe it or not, even televisions.
Wow.
They are constructed with an internal walkway around the base perimeter, maybe 2 or 3 feet wide, leaving an open area in the center where holes can be drilled and the occupants can fish. Usually, fishermen end up drilling additional holes outside the Bob House, especially if the fish are not biting in the Bob House holes. After drilling a hole in the ice, to give you a little idea how this works, after drilling a hole in the ice with an auger, setting the trip mechanism and dropping the bait in the hole, you can sit in the Bob House and watch until a perch or trout tips the flag. This is a great way to while away the hours, enjoying a hot cup of coffee or perhaps something even more stimulating. Now, no self-respecting Bob House is without a pot-bellied stove. Believe me, after catching a fish and putting it in with your bare hands, with temperatures in the low 20s, the warmth of a pot-bellied stove is very much appreciated. And let me tell you a little bit about tip-ups. Most ice fishermen use tip-ups as opposed to fishing rods, because with the fishing rod, you have to stand over a single hole in the ice. With tip-ups, however, you can actually watch several holes at the same time from a warm Bob House while you wait for a flag to trip. Now, the operation of the tip-up is really very simple. There are a variety of designs, but basically it is a piece of wood approximately 12 inches long and 2 inches wide with a 1-inch hole in the center. There's a spool holding a small amount of line and a trip mechanism very similar to that of a mousetrap. The line and hook are passed through the hole in the tip-up, and after baiting the hook, it is dropped into the hole in the ice, and the device is laid over the hole. When the bait is even slightly disturbed, the sensitive spring mechanism trips the flag. As soon as the device is trip and the flag appears, it is imperative to immediately grab the line with your bare hands, and as soon as you feel resistance, set the hook. Another nice thing about ice fishing is you can just leave the fish lying on the ice where they keep well refrigerated until it's time to go home. And that, my friends, is pretty much the story on ice fishing. Neil, back to you.
I got a question. This is Chuck.
Go ahead, Chuck.
You say these bob houses are sitting out on the ice and some of them are got carpeting, TV sets, and everything else. What happens when a big gust of wind comes up? What stops them from sliding across the ice?
What happens, Chuck, is after a while, you know, during the day, the sun beats down on the ice a little bit, and when you have pressure, these houses are pretty heavy. The pressure on the ice, they're actually frozen into the ice.
Oh, okay. I can see that.
In fact, that's why one of the problems is why they end up in the creek, because the guys have trouble getting them out. They freeze so much into the ice.
Yeah, okay.
Just wondering.
Any other questions?
Yeah, Howard, this is Jim. I remember as a boy up in Maine, we used to use the smelt shanties every day in the winter if we could. But one of the things I remembered, of course, I'm talking about ice fishing on the Kennebec River. And, of course, that's quite a free-flowing river. And, of course, you get to the little inlets along the river, and that'll be frozen. And, of course, we're catching smelt by the hundreds of thousands. And it's one of the staples in Maine in the winter. And I remembered the only thing that disgusted me a bit was we didn't use a potbelly stove. We used kerosene heaters, and the fumes from those kerosene heaters sometimes will be enough to drive you out of the house, you know?
Yeah, I can believe it. Yeah.
But we used to build the smelt shanties. Like you say, we would build a skeleton with just the wooden frame, and then we would use
Well, you can't think of what you would use, huh, Jim?
We'd paint the burlap bags until they would become stiff. And so, in other words, you can get a nice building going for very little cost. Yeah. But I enjoyed it as a boy very much.
Yeah. Well, I'm familiar with the smelt fishing. We did that up there in New Hampshire also. We would go out at night with headlamps and nets. And when they're running as fast as you can scoop them up, you got a bushel basket full.
Wow.
Right.
Well, we have some more stories. And, Jim, let's bring go ahead and introduce Cecile. I think she's got a guest tonight.
Yes, Cecile. Why don't you introduce your friend Charles? From what we hear, he has fished in waters far away from South Florida. And, of course, we'd like to hear one of his favorite fishing stories and competing in various fishing events. Charles?
Okay, I will introduce. His name is Charles Berkeley, and he has a 50-ton captain's license, and here is Charles Berkeley.
Hi, guys. How are you all doing tonight?
Good, Charles. Fine. Good.
Good.
I tell you, I'm listening to this ice fishing and these bluefin tuna running off of Nova Scotia, and I'm sort of South Florida born and bred, and that's awful cold to me. I'm a little bit of a fair weather southern tropical guy. If a palm tree can't grow there, I probably won't fish there. So, but I've been fortunate to jump in and maybe just share a couple things.
Sure.
I've been lucky enough to fish. I made a little here or there on different things. I get the chance to fish a couple tournaments here and there. I've been fortunate enough to fish off Australia and Hawaii and Venezuela, Virgin Islands, San Lucas, Costa Rica, Bahamas, of course, and here in Florida. And I can tell you that I've caught nothing with the best of them sometimes. So, you know, I don't know that, I guess what they say, a bad day of fishing is better than a good day of working, and I will agree to that one.
There you go.
Cecile wanted me to try to think of a story or two, and you know, fishermen, we always have those, but I'm mostly a billfish guy. I'm fishing for marlin or sailfish or swordfish here in South Florida. We do what's kite fishing for sailfish and tournaments, among other techniques. But you literally put up a kite, put out some live baits hanging out there, and you put out maybe two or three kites, so you have six or eight or ten lines spread out, and all of a sudden you could have two, three, four quad fish on at the same time, and it's a regular Chinese fire drill and a lot of fun. We also do sword fishing. A number of years ago, the sword fisheries, like the bluefin fisheries, were essentially wiped out, certainly parts of the area, and here was no different. And I guess about, I don't know, 10, 12, 14 years ago, after they sort of banned some of the longliners, our sword fishery, which is sort of a nursery area off the South Florida here, started coming back, and a couple of guys started going out catching swordfish at night. And now, actually, they dropped down in the Gulf Stream with a 3 or 4 mile an hour current down, with a quarter, half mile of line out to the bottom during the daytime. But I still go at night on occasion, and they'll come up on the surface at night, and that's why you fish for them at night, different ways with glow sticks and different baits. But when this thing first started taking off here about 10 or 12 years ago, I thought, well, I'll give this a go. So I got my my big rods. They're called 50s with 50-pound test on them, sort of heavy-duty stand-up gear. And I'm sort of safety conscious, but I have a small boat at the time, a little 19-footer, and you run off about, I don't know, 10, 12, 14 miles off, and you're looking for certain bottom configurations. And you set up your bait, and away you go. Well, I had never caught a swordfish at that point. Like I said, I fished for marlin and some other things, but I was told, be careful. You get one of those big swordfish, and you'd lock down on them, they'll pull you out of the boat. I thought, okay, fine. So I get out there, and the first time I set up my baits, I was maybe in a little too shallow of water and didn't have any luck. And another week I went out, no luck. I had some baits knocked off, so I thought I'm getting close. And I even got the seal to go out with me one time, but it was a little too rough, so we had to come back in. And so the next week, and I thought, I'm going to get this. I'm going to get one of these suckers, and I couldn't get anybody to go with me. So I just went out by myself. You know, no big deal. I still do that to this day, but this was an interesting experience. Get out there and put out a couple of lines. You guys hear me okay?
Yes, yes.
Yes.
Okay, I just had some static there. So I put out, I was fishing two lines because I was by myself. And I thought, okay, this is cool. So I've got my lines out there, and all of a sudden, one of them starts screaming. Like, wow, this is pretty impressive. So I pulled the rod up. I tightened down on the drag. And they were right. It lifted me off my back foot. So that was like, whoa. Okay, so this is interesting. And it's just screaming out. They have one heck of a run. The swordfish are known for that. And so I'm fighting the swordfish. They stay down in the water. It's nighttime. You're all by yourself. And I'm fighting it for about maybe not too long, 10, 15 minutes. And I thought, well, I can't do a whole lot right now. So I'll try to wind in my other line while this fish is still taking out drag. I start cranking in the other line. I get it right up to the boat where the snaps will hit the tip of the rod, and at that point, the second one got hit right at the surface.
Oh.
So now I've got two swordfish on.
Oh,
I'm so far out of the league, I don't know what the heck to do. So I was like, oh, man, okay. So all I know is that the line that's tied to the boat, the one that's real short that I just brought up, I didn't realize it because it's nighttime, the snap swivel got stuck in the tip of the rod. So it wasn't letting any line out. You know, for a second, I thought, hey, maybe I can pull this off. And then when that rod started bending over with a 400-pound leader that I thought this rod was just going to snap and explode, I cowered about 3 or 4 feet away in my little boat waiting for this thing to go off with shrapnel and graphite flying all over the place. Fortunately, the leader, 400-pound leader, snapped, and it shot back like a gunshot. And I thought, well, I'm lucky on that. So I went to fight the other one, which has now almost fooled me, and I'm tied on the drag, and I pulled the hook. Okay, so at the end of the night, I got neither one of them, but you're talking to a guy who was so grateful he got neither one of them. The next time when I went out and I got, but I knew what I was doing, but I sure was way over my league on that one, and that was a little scary night, a thrill a minute, I got to tell you.
Yeah.
So still hadn't heard I almost got pulled out of the boat, but she's going, you're kidding. No, those things happen. But I got a chance to fish some tournaments down in the Cayman Islands. We got lucky. We won a tournament down there, and there's a little funny story there. I tell it, but it's people that fish for marlin will maybe give me a bad look, but I believe in releasing billfish. We pretty much release everything. Our sailfish is all released. We fish with circle hooks so we don't damage the fish anymore than need be. We release everything we can in the water. And rarely there's what's called a modified kill tournament. And usually that's a tournament where you have to, if you're going to bring a billfish or marlin to the dock, it has to be a minimum of a certain weight or over a prior record or something. In this particular case, down in the Caymans, they had a 300-pound minimum to bring a marlin to the dock. There were other fish considered for points in the tournament. But if it wasn't a 300-pound blue marlin, when you brought it to the dock, it was $299, you were disqualified from the tournament and probably run out of the town on a rail. So we were out there fishing. We are not in the money. We're way out of it. There's other guys with bigger points for their yellowfin tuna and some other things. And the very last day of the tournament, the last afternoon, we hooked into a nice big blue marlin, and we knew if we got it to the boat, it was big enough, it would put enough points on us that we could actually win the tournament on the last day. So we finally get the marlin up to the boat, and we're looking at it in the water. Is it over or is it under at 300 pounds? It's like, and the captain on our boat was a local, and he's, oh, man, it better be over 300 because I work here. I'll forever, for the rest of my life, be known as the baby killer if we bring that to the dock. So a couple of mates and I were talking about it and go, well, I'm thinking it's pretty close, and considering it's the last day of the tournament, if we get disqualified, we haven't won, lost anything anyway. So we boated the fish, which is maybe only the second blue marlin I've ever killed. And that's why people give you a dirty look when you say you killed a billfish. But there is a lot of money at stake, and it is a modified tournament, and so you don't – it's not like you're slaughtering a whole bunch. So we brought it in, radioed it out. We're coming in. Everybody's down at the dock. Here's this big marlin. We're bringing it up on the scales. And this poor guy, this poor native who's like sixth-generation Caymanian, he's sweating blood. He's going, oh, my God, oh, my God. If this isn't 300 pounds, I'm going to have the worst reputation in town and so on and so forth. It tipped the scale at 306 pounds.
Wow.
The sigh of relief, you could hear it for miles. And yeah. We ended up winning that tournament, and I had a chance to fish the offshore championship down in Cabo. So it was a great time, but it's not a policy most people will do about killing a billfish, you know. So we went a few bucks on that. It's been a fun trip. I've never seen a 1,000-pound marlin. I mean, I've never caught one. I've seen one. I was off Australia and saw what was probably 1,100 or 1,200-pound black came up on one line. It was just like a Volkswagen car coming out of the water. It was absolutely huge. Just really some good memories. So everywhere you go, like you say, whenever you fish, whether it's ice fishing or running in the freezing cold where Parker's chasing bluefin up there, there's almost no trip that doesn't mean something. They're all really good. And last but not least, probably my favorite place to fish, and it's a little hard to do these days, is off of Venezuela. They have all kinds of different species of billfish. You can get a slam, which is three different species in one day, and that's one of the places in the world you can do it. It's just absolutely fabulous. And I did have a chance to fish down there a while back before things got too crazy. And you pilots out there will know what I'm talking about. I've got to say, the Venezuelan women are absolutely the best-looking women on the planet. So, I'm going to turn you over to Steele.
Wait, I presume from that statement that Cecile is Venezuelan, is that correct?
She's Ecuadorian, but close enough.
Close enough.
Do you guys have any questions or anything I can answer? I'd love to do what I can.
Charles, this is Jim from born in Maine, and I remembered going out with a cousin of mine who had a beautiful 32-foot boat with a diesel engine. You could eat off the floor in that thing, but we were going out this one day for bluefin tuna. And would you believe we hooked onto a 1,000-pounder?
Oh, mama.
And he said, we're going to have to let this one get tired. And he had a rig where he would take a beer keg, and he would tie it to his line, and the beer keg had a red flag on the top of it, a stick and a red flag. And he just threw it over the side. He said, let's go see if we can't find another one. I said, well, aren't you afraid of losing this one? No. But sure enough, the fish tired. We went. We found the flag. We pulled him in. He got on his radio. He carried all kinds of ice in the boat. But we got on the radio, and we called this firm who met us at Bailey Island. You may have heard of the Bailey Island Tuna Tournament. It's big every year. We went into Bailey Island, and the truck met us there. Of course, we were about 10 feet on the dock below the truck, and the truck had a winch on it. He hooked onto the tuna, brought it up to his truck, iced it there, gave my cousin an invoice for it. They weighed it. It was a little over 1,000 pounds.
Wow.
And would you believe it was about a week or two later, He got a check in the mail for almost $11,000.
Wow.
And it showed on the invoice what they charged him to transport it and so on. Well, that fish, the Portland airport, isn't too far from Bailey Island. And I'm sure they put it on a plane as soon as they could. And that thing was in Japan within a matter of hours. And
how long ago was this?
Oh, gosh. It had to be 20, 25 years ago.
You know, they still do the same thing today, but the checks are not $11,000.
Oh.
They're multiple six figures.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh.
And they fish today, absolutely. A good quality, well-caught, quick-release bluefin tuna that runs up in Japan. And they, it's an amazing thing. I didn't get to see it, but a friend of mine in my fishing club did go to the Tokyo Fish Market, and where they bring in these tuna and they actually grade them and auction them off. He says it's like multiple football fields of nothing but seafood and fish from around the world and tuna. And these tuna today, you could get a $500,000 for that fish.
Wow.
I mean, it's just insane. Well, that's
Jim,
I got to tell you, that's my goal, is to catch a grander one day.
I'm going to ask the obvious question. How much does that tuna cost if you eat it at a meal in Japan?
Well, yeah. I don't know. I've been in Japan, but I will bet you a little piece of sushi is probably $30.
Wow.
It's getting up there.
Jim, we have another professional fisherman here. Would you introduce George?
Oh, George Jin, yes. George, tell us a bit about what you know about maybe the race and out that way. I know you mentioned that these fellows go about 80 miles out. And if you went 80 miles out and then went due north, you're about 80 or 100 miles off the coast of Maine and Massachusetts. Am I right there?
Well, what we do is, here in New York, we go out to one of the canyons, depending upon where the largest temperature break is, because that's where, I don't know if you're familiar with the East Coast here up north, but we have what's called the Continental Shelf.
Yes.
And years ago, where, like, the Hudson River came into the continental shelf, it dug out these very deep canyons that would be, like, similar to the Grand Canyon, but under the salt water. So those are the spots that we fish, and sometimes we go out southwest, sometimes east, sometimes southeast, depending upon where the best reports have been. But I have a really an interesting story about one such trip. You know, I fish for tuna quite a bit out of Montauk Point, which is located on the very eastern tip of Long Island. And the trips normally span 2 or 3 days because, you know, you're going out 80 or 90 miles. And the tuna are schooled up at those various canyons, you know, where the water depths drop from usually around 300 feet to well over 3,000 feet in a very short distance. So the fishermen wait all year for the late summer and autumn months to head out on one of those trips, which are normally done for those of us who are a bit parsimonious on a party or a headboat, because it's a lot cheaper that way. They take about, I don't know, 25 or 30 people. And about 5 years ago, I sailed on one such trip with two of my friends. Before we left, the reports were excellent. Anglers were catching anywhere from 5 to 10 yellowfin, big eye, and albacore tuna apiece. Now, at the start of the show, Neil, if I recall right, played a tune about drinking the beer while out fishing. Of course, you know, the same thing happens on these party boat trips. However, one such trip that I went on, one angler imbibed just a bit too much until he was pretty intoxicated, and he was also pretty obnoxious. Well, during the start of the very first evening, this gentleman was so drunk that he fell and injured his leg, and he swore it was broken. Well, if that was the case, we would have had to immediately head back to get him to the hospital or to a doctor. But before the captain did this, he inquired over the public address system and asked if there were any doctors on board. Well, one of my buddies who was with me went to the captain and informed him that he was a doctor. So he examined the gentleman's leg. This is the fellow who was drunk, and gave his official diagnosis that it was only a sprain and wasn't broken, and that if he fished from a chair, if he could do that for the remainder of the trip, that everything would be okay. And, of course, this guy was, you know, in pretty bad shape. The only problem is that my buddy was an auto mechanic. But the result was that we stayed out with this guy moaning and groaning for the two entire days, and we hauled in plenty of tuna. Well, when we returned to the dock, the guy with the leg went to a local hospital where a real doctor told him that the leg was indeed broken. So he called the boat and wanted from the captain, he wanted to get the name of the doctor who had misdiagnosed him with a sprain because he wanted to sue him. Of course, the captain gave him some fictitious name. But the bottom line was that it turned out to be a great trip for everyone else, despite this guy. The moral is, if you want to fish, don't drink too much.
You know? That, oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
That was one of the best all-time trips that I've ever been on.
All right, that's the number. That's the second rule. The first rule is don't eat the bait.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
I know someone would bring that up.
Well, we have a great fishing tale about catching a fish that was to be a world record. Sometimes a fish story can get around among friends that might not really be exactly the way it was.
Mr. Samples, I understand you caught a big bass on Lake Lanier.
Well, he was a pretty good size.
How big was he?
22 pounds and 9 ounces.
22 pounds and 9 ounces. Well, the world's record, of course, is 22 pounds and 4 ounces. I believe you'd have one five ounces over that.
Well, I thought he's 25 pounds something. I mean, I took the fish home, brought him home, cleaned him, need him. I didn't know that. Well, I never thought about being nothing like that. I mean, I didn't think I had no record. I know that I had a record, but I didn't think I did on the fish.
Did you measure him?
Yeah, 32 inches long.
Where'd you weigh him at?
Well, I don't know. I was drunk. We weighed him summers, and they didn't nobody dispute the word. Everybody asked how much he weighed, and I'd just tell them how much he weighed, and then didn't nobody offer to weigh him again. I showed him all over county. I reckon I did. I think I did.
Plenty of people saw the fish then?
There's plenty of people see the fish.
What'd you catch him on?
A little bitty spring lizard. A little bitty white-bellied spring lizard.
What kind of tackle was you using?
Using a Zebby Cole 33 with, I think, a 12-pound test line. It's 8 or 12, and I'm not sure which. But, he didn't put up much fight as a two-pounder would. He just, after he come up and stood on that tail and chuck that head about three or four times, he just turned over on his side and just drug him right on in.
Did he jump? He jumped once then, you say?
One time, yeah. That's all.
Well, what area of the lake was you fishing in?
I was fishing about a mile below Ball Ridge Marina. About a mile down the lake, below Ball Ridge, on the Smurd Island.
Out in the big part of the lake, then.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what made you cast over there on that Smurd Island, anyway?
Well, I dropped anchor rock there on the island, and I pitched my little outfit, that little 33 out, and I had some heavy equipment there in the boat, had a big 55, and I was going to put big lizard on them and get ready for big bass, and I just got one hooked, and I looked over and seed my line stretching out, straightened out, you know, see it stretching out. I reached down and caught him. When I jerked him, I thinks I'm hung, for it didn't go nowhere when I jerked. That's about it. I mean, he come up there, stood on that tail, and that about wound it up.
How come you didn't take him up to the marina and get him weighed right away?
Well, I didn't think nothing about it. I mean, I was fishing for something to eat.
Do you know what the world's record bass was?
No.
You haven't have any idea?
I thought it was 25 pounds something or other. That's how come I didn't. I could have, I mean, if I'd known that that is it, well, I might have weighed him or something other, you know, somewhere. No, we did weigh him, but I don't know where. I thought weighed him down at Johansson, but Grace said, Darrell said he didn't weigh him down there, so I don't guess we weighed him down there.
How did the fish eat?
Good.
How often did you have him? More than one meal?
Three messes.
Three messes. What, supper and breakfast?
Supper, dinner, and breakfast. Supper, breakfast, and dinner. Put it like that, that's the way we eat him.
Well, if you catch another big fish like that, weighs over 22 pounds, what are you going to do with it?
I'm going to have him a picture took every time I can get to Kodak and frame him. I didn't know how to record.
Jenna, you like to fish a lot, don't you?
Well, I've let work has hindered my fishing last 2 years. It never done it before then, but it has for the last 2 years. But it ain't going to hinder it so much from now on, for I'm going to do a bunch of fishing.
What's the biggest bass you caught before this?
I'm not certain. I think 12 pound 4 ounces.
You do a lot of hunting?
Yeah.
You do any good?
I got me a 12 point buck last year.
Have it down at Cedar Creek?
Got him at Greensboro. On the Putwood land.
What kind of business you in, Mr. Sample?
Jim Hart, I've got one thing to say about Junior Samples. If you've ever watched Hee Haw, Junior Samples was discovered by that very story that you just heard. And it passed all over the county, and everybody started talking about Junior's big bass. And Junior Samples used to fish right at my boathouse on Lake Lanier in Ball Ridge Marina. And I'd see him out there. I'd always know it was Junior sitting in his little boat. And he liked to fish off my dock, beneath my boathouse, rather. We couldn't put anything permanent on Lake Lanier. It was an Army Corps of Engineer lake in Atlanta, north of Atlanta. And so we had them on poles and styrofoam blocks to support the weight of the boathouse. But I had a two-boat slip boathouse fully enclosed. And, boy, I tell you, the crappie were just plentiful there. And everybody seemed to like that point right around the corner from Ball Ridge, and especially Junior Samples. And I could always identify Junior sitting out there in his boat fishing, because he had the same coveralls or overalls or whatever you want to call them, old Union overalls, with a yellow shirt. And he wore that mainly on Hee Haw when he told his not too factual or truthful stories. And Junior was a good storyteller. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah. Chuck, I wonder, I'll bet you can top that story, can you? What do you have for us?
I don't know if I can top that story, because I never got to be on television with a yellow shirt. But a friend of mine invited me to go fishing down in the Keys in Alamorada. His corporation, he was a young guy, too. He was about 26, 27 years old. And he had his captain's license, and the corporation had three boats. One was a 56, and the other was about a 25 or 26. And then they had a little ski boat that was like 12 or 14. But anyway, they had a condo down there, and we went down there Friday and got everything all rigged out and ready to go. And slept over and got up early in the morning, got out there and got on the 26-footer. I guess the if anybody fishes down in the Keys, the Gulf Stream comes fairly close 10, 15 miles. You can still see the buildings out there, and then on the other side you can see the big cargo ships going down through the Florida Keys there. So we were out, I guess, about 15 miles out looking for some billfish, and we trolled and we trolled and we trolled, and I guess we trolled about 4 or 5 hours, and we didn't get a thing. And my buddy was fit to be tied, because he'd always been telling me, boy, I've been fishing out here, and I got this big fish, and I got that big fish. And I said, yeah, well, next time you go, take me with you. I'd like to get a billfish. I haven't had one in years. So he says, let's give it up, Chuck, and we'll go back, and we'll try to find a weed line or something and see what we can pick up inside. So we come on back inside, and sure enough, he found a weed line. It looked like it was probably about a mile and a half or 2 miles long, somewhere in there. And we started following it. We had four rigs, two on the outriggers and two in the back, and we had bait on them. And one of them got hit, so we slowed down a little bit. And pretty soon another one got hit. And I started reeling in, and we got ourselves into this big school of dolphins. Now, that's not the dolphin you see on TV. It's the mahi-mahi that you eat in the restaurants. So I don't want anybody to get confused there that we got a bunch of mammals out there. But anyway, we started flipping the bait back and forth, and pretty soon he grabbed the two outriggers and grabbed them off, and he took the bait off of them and just put a shiny spoon on it. And we started pulling them in with a spoon, so we had four rods, and as fast as we could pull them in, we got these fish that were anywhere from a pound and a half all the way up. I think we got a big bull that was probably 15 or 20 pounds, which was good eating fish. So we got tired of pulling fish in. Finally, he says, we're going to have to quit and go in. It's going to start getting dark. And he says, you start getting the fish all ready to go. And he had a big ice chest, and those things were just flopping around in the ice. So we get back. And he says, well, Chuck, you get them down the fish board and start cleaning them up, and I'll go get gas the boat up, because that's the deal with the corporation. You had to gas the boat up and clean it up, and he washed it all up. And I'm sitting there cleaning 56 dolphin that day from a pound and a half all the way up to, like, 20 pounds. And so I was putting them in these little Ziploc bags, and we're going to take them home because we're going to give them to the relatives. And everybody, because, you know, you like to brag about a good day's fishing. So I put the date on them, like he said, with one of the marking pencils. And he says, okay, now split half of them. I said, oh, you want your half? He says, no. He says, you've got to leave that half in the refrigerator. I said, what do you mean you got to leave it in the refrigerator? He says, because some guys come in here and they're snookered, and they don't want to go home with no fish and tell their wife they've been down here for the weekend and spent $300 or $400. And got no fish. So we gave them half our fish that day and brought the rest of it back up. So that was a great day of fishing.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of my favorite storytellers is Jerry Clower. And here's his secret of surely catching your limit of fish.
I went to see Marcel Ledbetter the other day. His brother Claude was the only one in the community catching any fish. Folks was going and they wasn't catching nothing. Old Claude Ledbetter, he'd come in with a pickup truck loaded down. So the State Game and Fish Commission of Mississippi decided they'd go fishing with Claude, just see how he was catching them. Claude had told them, popped off, said, y'all don't know how to do it. Said, y'all ought to just go with me and watch me. Well, a game warden got up in the boat with him, and they took off out in the middle of the river. And the game warden said, all right, Claude, I'm going to see how you catching all these fish when can't nobody else catch none. Claude raised the lid on the boat seat and got a big, long stick of dynamite. Lit the fuse on it. Let it go down to kind of short and draw it back and chunked it. Boom! And them big catfish come turning their belly up, whooping it out of that water, and Claude is just getting them by the tub full. Game warden said, boy, that's against the law. You can't do that. Don't you know you breaking the law? Well, Claude's done lit another big stick of dynamite. Handed it to the game warden. It going, shh. Game warden took that stick of dynamite and said, you idiot, this is against the law. You can't do this. Claude said, you going to sit there and argue or fish?
Oh, that's good.
That's very good. I just thought I should maybe mention about the Eastern Airlines Flying Fishermen's Club. Have you
yes,
heard about
dude.
That?
Yes, I have. Go ahead and tell us about it, Jim.
Well, I'm going back now 30, 35 years when the marketing department was looking for something to bolster our traffic north to south in the wintertime. And one of the guys said, well, listen, a lot of people up north here do fishing. Why not to concentrate on fishing and maybe get some trips going down south for the fishermen? And he said, you know, the other thing, too, is I'll bet we've got a bunch of travel agents all over the United States who'd love to get groups going to our fishing areas. So they decided, okay, let's start the Flying Fishermen's Club. And what we did was go out to all of the district managers and sales reps, and we developed even a plastic Flying Fishermen's Club card. And we would give those to the travel agents, and they would begin booking. And everyone who booked into the Flying Fishermen's Club got a Flying Fishermen's plastic card. And it was one of the best promotions in years. And I don't know, of course, I left the company in 1968. Don't know what happened after that, but maybe someone listening could tell us if they remember. It was a wonderful promotion.
Yeah, I've read about it in some of the books, and I tried to research it the other day and was unable to find where I'd found a lot of information about that. But I think that was back in the 50s, Jim, if my memory serves me right.
Yeah, mine was, of course, in 57 when I joined the company. And
yeah.
But anyway, Neil, we haven't heard much from you. Now, try to be truthful if you can. Do you have a fishing story?
Don't have a story, but an invitation. I got to thinking about our show tonight and a lot of fun that we have fishing, or at least the guys, and I know a lot of ladies like to fish as well. My mother was one of the most avid fisher person ladies that I ever knew, and she had fishing holes all over the southwest part of Florida. She had a fishing a cottage. We had a fishing cottage, I should say, over in the Fort Myers Bonita Springs area, and we caught snook and all sorts of fish there. And my little brother became a real fisherman. As a matter of fact, his career wound up being in the marine business and owned several marinas in southwest Florida, owns one in Fort Myers now, and also down in Marathon. And I thought to myself, you know, I'd like to maybe put together a little fishing trip down to Marathon. He's got a beautiful home down there. It can accommodate, golly, I don't know how many people. And to top it off, he's got a 53-foot Buddy Davis sports fisherman boat. Beautiful boat. I've been out on it several times, and we've caught dolphin. I've caught sailfish with him, and he's been doing it all of his life just about. And I finally got him interested in flying, so he soloed at the age of 65. So he's got three airplanes now. He loves flying. And boy, it would be fun to have, especially all the hosts that we could get down and do some serious fishing. Perhaps Charles and George could show us how to bait the hook and catch the big ones. But it would be fun. But that's about all I've got. I think Cecile, Jim, go ahead and
yeah, Cecile, have you ever been fishing with Charles? And can you verify his fishing abilities?
Yes, I can definitely verify, because we have a freezer full. We had a freezer full of swordfish, caught a couple of swordfish, 200 to 300 pounder. But if we could have 1 minute, I can tell you a real quick story. He took me fishing in the Keys, and I caught, I'll put him on. He can tell you what I caught, because then I had no clue what I caught or what I did. All I know is that the 20, 30 members of the fishing club kept coming to me and saying, congratulations. Hold on, Charlie will tell it real quickly.
Well, real fast. The weather had gotten really bad, but we were trying to do a little tarpon fishing, so I thought, well, if I get one, I'll give it to her. So the guy dropped a little shrimp to the bottom so she could fish with some snapper and keep herself busy in the bad weather. I don't think the little shrimp hit the bottom before her line took off. She's fishing with a little spinning reel with 15-pound test, and a little over 2 hours later, we released a tarpon that wasn't 10 to 1, but was probably close to 140 pounds. Yeah, and she looked exhausted and beat like she'd been hit by a Mack truck, and I don't think she ever wants to go again. Too much of a good thing, you know.
All I know is all the fishing club members kept congratulating me. I have no clue what I did, but it was fun.
What John, she did was catch one of the hardest fishes to catch.
Yeah.
That's right, yeah.
John Ruth, are you still with us? John Ruth. Okay, I think he dropped off the line. But, yeah, the invitation is there. Perhaps next year we can go down to he is right. His home is right on the Atlantic side. He's about probably a half mile from the Atlantic through a little canal. I think his home is right on the entrance of that canal there in Marathon. And beautiful fishing in that area. He also has a house over in Bimini, and he flies over there and does a lot of lobstering at his condominium there in Bimini. But I'm going to take advantage of all the toys my little brother has. You know, I can't afford them, but he has them, so why not use them?
Hey, Neil, this is Charlie down here.
Yeah, Charlie.
If your brother needs any hand when he's running over to Bimini to rig lines, rig bait, anytime he needs an extra soulmate on board, just have him give me a holler, and I think one way or another I could figure my way south.
I'm going to do that. As a matter of fact, as soon as I can, he and I are going to a show that we go every year at Sebring, Florida in January, and it's a light sports aircraft show. Matter of fact, last year we went to it, and he bought a little light sport airplane. He had to have it, and he bought that, and it was way up in I think Wisconsin, where this guy took it and built it, and I offered to fly it back from Wisconsin, but it had a top speed of about 80 miles an hour, so it would have taken me all year to get back down to South Florida, but he managed to get a flight instructor that wanted to build his time to go with the airlines, and but at any rate, I'm gonna see if that might be possible. And you guys, anyone wanting to come down, I think you'd have a good time. He loves to have people to entertain fishing, especially fishing. And
well, I'll be glad to help out too on anything at all. So I look forward to
very
it.
Very good.
Listen, I know
very
we're
good.
Running out of time, so I'm going to give the phone back to Cecile here.
Okay, very good.
I'll go in the airplane.
Okay. George, perhaps you can get a pass down to Marathon some if we can put this thing together. We'll go out and have a good time.
I can certainly do that. You know, now that the U.S. Air American merger is completed, that's probably one of the best things that could have happened for me, you know, as a retired U.S. Air pilot.
Yeah, there you go. And,
yeah,
perhaps I can coax Howard to come down and since he's not ice fishing and go with us. But I think we'd have a good time down there.
You know, being that I get all these passes on American, why don't we make it in Australia or New Zealand or something like that?
Some place real expensive, right?
Yeah, there you go. Very good. Well, I think we're getting close to the end here, Jim.
And, yeah, so I was going to say that, Neil, folks, that's all the news about fishing on Lake Wobegon, as Garrison Keillor would say. We do have a few announcements. Neil, do you have one about the website, especially about ordering books written by our authors that we've interviewed on the show this year?
Yeah, we've got two of our authors that we interviewed this year. George Jen wrote Flying Too Close to the Sun. I'm sitting here looking at his book on my bookshelf here. And also Howard Mucci, another book that I can see here at the golden microphone, as Rush Limbaugh would call it, excellent in broadcasting. But we've interviewed about four people this past year or this year, and their books are available, especially this time of year, that you might want to order as a present. And I've made it easier to find on our website since I reformatted the entire website for the EAL Radio Club, and a lot of pages that in the past were displayed at the very top of each page. We didn't have enough room, so we have one of the icons in the toolbar says Other, O-T-H-E-R. And if you click on Other, you'll see a drop-down menu. And then not too far down the menu, you'll see Book Review. And if you go to that book review, you can review the author's little bio there and about the book itself and what it's all about and how to order. You can order right there on the website. And it's very easy to do, and just click it on and find that click that will take you to the author's website, or either author's email or the address of the publisher, or I think we've got one on Amazon, a couple of them on Amazon.com and one on Lulu Press, which is Howard's book. And there you can order. All of them are very reasonable and make great Christmas gifts. And I've got one other announcement that I got today from the Retired Eastern Pilots Association is having its annual Christmas party, REPA. It's a luncheon, and it's going to be held December 10th, which is just a few days from now, it's tomorrow. And this will be their Christmas luncheon, and anyone wanting to go, it's a good Christmas story to get up, get in the spirit of things. They would appreciate just bringing a good Christmas story. Of course, they always welcome any type of stories and jokes. They like to tell a lot of jokes. Also, you might want to bring your dues if you are a member of the Retired Eastern Pilots Association, because that's a favorite time of collecting. Very modest due of $40 a year. And for affiliate members, it's only $35 a year. And it gives you some a couple of great magazines during the year that have a lot of great pilot stories, old-time pilots, and also the pilots that have shared their memories in that magazine. As always, they always start their meetings at the Piccadilly Cafeteria, located on Godby Road there in Atlanta. It's just off National Highway, southwest of the Atlanta Airport. And they have their luncheon starting at 11 a.m., and they have some great door prizes. So you might want to drop in if you're in the Atlanta area. And they take any Eastern employee. You don't have to be a retired pilot, just want to share some good Eastern camaraderie, and you'll find it there plentiful. That's about all I've got.
Do I hear the champagne music yet?
Well, we'll see if we can get Lawrence Welk to crank up the band.
I went to see Marcel.
That's not it.
That's not it.
That doesn't sound like Lawrence Welk.
There it is, folks. Now I hear the champagne music in the background, so it must be time to say goodnight. We hope you enjoyed tonight's show, and you'll tell your friends about us, especially tell other members of the Eastern family. Tune in next week when the radio voice of Eastern Airlines brings you another exciting show. We wish you a very successful week. And so from all of us here at the EAL Radio Show, until next week, keep the blue side up, have plenty of airspeed and plenty of altitude. And good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern family.
Good night, Eastern family.
Good night.
night.